Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hey everybody, this is Spencer. I'm going to give you a quick lead-in into the episode you're about to listen to. Back when we had Jason Denzel on the podcast, he mentioned an interview of Kate Redding and Michael Kramer, and since then a lot of you have been asking for it, and now finally we're going to get it out to you. This podcast will not actually have any of the podcasters on it. The interview was conducted by Jason Denzel of DragonMount.com and Bob Klutz of Encyclopedia Watt.
Hello?
Hi, Jennifer?
Yes, hi.
Hi, this is Jason Denzel and Bob Klutz. How are you doing?
Hi, hello. Jason and Bob. I'm fine. How are you?
Hi, good. Michael. How are you?
Michael?
Bob, you're hearing.
Oh, sorry. I thought
Bob
I was
too.
Yeah, sorry. I was confused. I got to figure out who's on the line here. So,
let me get Michael on the line too.
Okay, great.
See, look at Bob. It didn't take him long. He got confused real quick.
I'm already confused.
Michael,
yeah.
Can you pick up?
Okay.
He just got back from playing basketball.
Oh, okay. That way, he sounds nice and exhausted, like he's been working
yeah.
hard all day or something.
Hi.
Did you hear that?
Oh, are you on? Hello, Michael.
Yes.
Hi, this is Jason Denzel. I'm the webmaster over at DragonMount.com, and cool. I've got Bob Klutz on the line here as well.
Hi, Michael. How are you? Good.
How are you guys doing this evening?
Fine.
The yeah. kids asleep and everything like that? I understand you have some young children?
Yes, we have two. We have a 9-year-old boy called Henry and a 4-year-old girl called Vivian.
That's great. My wife Jennifer and I are expecting our first, so we're going to be diving into the parenthood.
Sleep while you can.
Yeah, we're going to try that. That's what we keep hearing, and so we'll be able to sleep in until 10 a.m. for the next couple months, and then that's it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so thank you guys both for taking the time to join us for this interview. Just wanted to give you a little bit of background you may or may not know. Dragonmount.com is the website that I'm running. It's one of the larger Wheel of Time fan sites, and Bob's in charge of the Wheel of Time Encyclopedia, which is .org, I believe.
Oh, wonderful.
And they're both pretty popular sites. A lot of people visiting there every day, and we're always looking to interview different people involved with the Wheel of Time. And so this is something that is, I think a lot of people have been looking forward to, I was going to say reading about, but hearing about, because the audiobooks are, as you probably know, quite popular with the fans.
Yeah.
So, starting us off, most Robert Jordan fans are probably not familiar with your work outside of the Wheel of Time. Can you tell us a little bit about yourselves?
You want me to go first?
Yeah, go ahead.
Where do we begin? We've both been actors here for about 20 years in the Washington area and doing recorded books for about 15 years.
What sort of do you typically do, theater and stage, or do you typically do film? What sort of projects have you guys worked on before?
Mainly theater. In the Washington area, there's a really wonderful, vibrant theater community. There are some films that are made here, but neither of us has really done much with that. We're much more interested in the theater work.
That's really cool. Yeah, are you guys still actively doing it these days?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. You got any projects coming up right now or any
I'm
shows?
About to start rehearsing Electra at a theater called Metro Stage.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Very cool. What's it like working together? Do you have a chance to work in various theater projects together, or do you usually do your own things?
We met doing a project together, and then it took us 19 years before we actually worked on another project together. It just happened to be that when I would work at a theater that Jen worked at regularly, she was working at a theater that I worked at regularly, and so we kind of tag-teamed, or the paths never really crossed in terms of the work we did until just recently this past spring. And then once Henry was born 9 years ago, it made the world of theater a lot more interesting in terms of trying to figure out child care and all that.
So with regards to your voice acting careers, how did you transition into that? How did you get started?
The first thing I did was I joined the Woolly Mammoth Theatre Company, and one of the company members was working at the time as a narrator, Grover Gardner. And he was also working at the Library of Congress Recording Studios. They have a Recorded Books for the Blind program. That's a really wonderful program that's available to anyone who's blind or physically handicapped. And they record all sorts of different things. So I asked Grover about it and went up to the Library of Congress. They have a studio in Northwest D.C., and I started working there. And once I'd worked there for a couple of years, then sent out audition tapes for Books on Tape and also Blackstone, and started working with them. And so it gradually became something that I did. And we both still work at the Library of Congress Recording Studios because we think it's a really great program.
So, Michael, did you get into the voice acting through Kate?
Actually, it was through the same friend, but no, kind of independent of that, because I worked as an engineer, I want to say, for about 3 years, just listening, basically being the person who ran the machines, you know, the tape recorders at that point, because we were still doing
reel-to-reel.
Reel-to-reel tapes. Back in the stone, you know, when we fed the squirrels the peanuts to, you know, turn the motors. It just happened, simultaneously it happened that the studio that I was working in as an engineer, the head of that studio saw me in a play and said, you really have got to submit a book or a audio tape in. And she kind of pushed, that was Flo Gibson, and I was kind of hired simultaneously by Blackstone and then by Books on Tape and the Library of Congress, literally within a month of each other. And it's an interesting, you know, the voice side of it is big, as far as acting goes, theater, I guess, is primarily vocal work. Whereas film is much more of a visual medium, so the behind the microphone kind of stuff, the storytelling aspect of it was kind of fit hand in glove with our theater training, and actually complemented it, because you know telling a story to a microphone, you know, we're reading a book basically is telling a story, whether it's a self-help book or a financial book or a piece of fiction or nonfiction. And it's the same as being on stage. The only difference being that, for the most part, when you're on stage, you only have one character, and with this you get to do the whole thing, which presents its own challenges in terms of, you know, making choices that are sustainable. And I think probably the hardest thing is learning how to handle narrative as opposed to the dialogue, because as an actor, you're trained to do dialogue almost from the get-go. And learning how to pace yourself and to find that right tone for the narrative portions of the piece or whatever it is the, I think, probably for me anyway, was the hardest challenge.
When I started recording at the Library of Congress, Grover used to monitor me, and I would run out of breath when I got to a narrative section because I didn't know how to find my way through it. I didn't know how to find the energy of the piece, whereas the dialogue was no problem because that was just like playing a character. And I remember Grover sort of coaching me through that and teaching me how to find the line of the energy through the sentence in the narrative pieces. It was fascinating to learn. And I remember the first time I sort of was able to tackle a really big narrative paragraph and didn't run out of breath, you know, and it felt like, oh, okay, now I see. It's just like dialogue. It's just a little different, but it's the same thing. It's the same attack.
A lot of your earlier recording was done at the Library of Congress, but I understand that most of your voice acting now you do out of your home studio?
Yes, we work for a couple different companies. Anyone who will hire us, basically.
Besides The Wheel of Time, what other books have you performed?
Oh, well, I did a number of the James Patterson, Yannickus, I think with I was doing about half of them for a while, every other one. My favorite author, I think I have to say, would be Donald E. Westlake. I had to, I think, virtually the whole Dortmunder series. And then, actually, one of the first authors that I worked with, which was kind of great in a way, was John Jakes. I was handed the 8-volume, I think, 4,000-page Kent Family series, which was the kind of bicentennial, where we started in France and then moved through colonial America, meeting all the famous personages up through the end of the Civil War. And in terms of just, okay, it's a Scot, and he just came off the boat. It's a Hungarian composer. It's, you know, it's de Tocqueville, or it's Lafayette, or it's George Washington, or it's Robert E. Lee. It's all these personages that you meet. I guess another favorite book of mine, I have to say, is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, because it was a personal Bible when I was going through college, and then all of a sudden, 21 years later, I got to record it, so that was, I guess, a lot of fun. But I'm, you know, we both have probably over 200 or 300 titles under our belt.
Yeah, each. And the types of companies we work for, really, they cover such a wide span. I mean, I've done everything from a Bombeck to, I did a lot of the Patricia Cornwell books for Books on Tape. I've done a lot of classics for Blackstone. And some of my favorites are like Thomas Hardy. And I did a wonderful Balzac book that to me was just like, oh my God, this guy's the Tom Wolfe of his time. You know, this really scathing indictment of the assholes that populate the society and the horrible things they do to each other. I do a lot of mysteries. Once you get hooked in with an author, if they're prolific, you find yourself doing a lot of their books, and it's nice because you know how they write, and so you don't have to spend a whole lot of time getting to know the writing, you already know it, and so you know, oh, that's this person, and I know how they write, I know how their rhythm goes. I just finished a fabulous book by a woman named Tricia Wastvedt called The River. She's British, and I talked to her a couple of times because I needed to find out about pronunciations. She's 50, I think, and this is her first book, and she was a postwoman, and she was a draftswoman. She's done all kinds of different things, and she just decided to go back to school, and she was studying writing, and she was writing these things, and people kept telling her, you know, this is really good. And so she published this book, and it's a beautiful, beautiful book. But we've both done a number of nonfiction books, mysteries, novels, classics, modern world. I mean, there's an incredible range, and I love that. I love not being stuck in a very narrow niche.
With all these projects that you guys have worked on, how many of them have you actually performed together, and what's it like to work together?
I want to say that I think outside of possibly one other project, normally we get, occasionally you do a piece like I did a Choice Cuts, I believe was the name of the book, and I was doing kind of the intro chapters and then an occasional article. That was a book about food, but for the most part, narrators tend to work individually. So this is almost a unique experience. And I think one of the reasons originally when Books on Tape originally got the series way back when, one of the reasons that they actually offered it to us was Robert Jordan had wanted a male and female voice. And the logistics of recording, trying to fit, editing it all together would have been very complicated if you have two people in different studios or even if they're in the same town. And this happened to just kind of, it was serendipitous that it kind of fell in our laps on the one hand. On the other, it was just a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his writing, it allows you to kind of go there. With a lot of books, you need to be restrained, and this kind of asks you, no, you've got to do, the voice of Loyal, for instance, is my favorite, voice probably in the whole bunch, but just all of a sudden being confronted with a four-page monologue by, this giant, and he's very explicit in to how the voice sounds, and you're like, okay, here's where I have to go. And that's, I guess, that's the other thing that what's nice about Mr. Jordan's writing is that he does give you clues right away to how they're going to sound. There's just, you can make choices.
Extreme choices.
Yeah, and they're fun choices. That's the other thing. He's got a wonderful sense of humor, which is, to me, always to be prized, because it's so much fun to read humor.
It was very funny too, because when we first started, I remember when we did the first book, I've never read fantasy. I have not even read The Lord of the Rings, but I may have to because Henry is very interested in it, so I may have to do that. But I've never been a big fantasy reader, so this is really my first encounter with the whole genre. And Michael's more familiar with it than I am, but we read through this stuff, and, first I looked at Michael and said, how are we supposed to know how to say all these names, And I think we contacted him, and he basically said, do what you like. And there's a glossary of sorts in the back of the book, but the pronunciation guide, the pronunciation key is a little confusing, so there are some words that we say that might not be how a lot of people think it's supposed to be said, but basically Mr. Jordan said, I don't care, just say it however you want. But we had to try to be consistent with each other, and we would have these raging fights where I would come in and say, what? Are you saying whatever the word was, Asmodeon? No, it's Asmodeon. What are you talking about? And we'd have these huge fights in the kitchen about, no, but I said this, and, well, I'm saying this. We had a big fight about Brigitte or Brigitta, How do you say that? And then the other thing that was funny was the first person to encounter a character basically had the power to decide what their voice sounded like. And I'll never forget when I first encountered Loyal, and I said, oh, Michael, what does Loyal sound like? And he did Loyal's voice. So I was like, what? I have to do that?
So you guys have mentioned Loyal twice now. Does Loyal sound like exactly? For all the people listening right now on the internet.
Loyal speaks like this.
the way he describes it is it's so deep, and yet Loyal is a wonderful character because he's so warm. And he's so conscientious and obsessed. He's the epitome of the gentle giant.
Kate, is that correct? Was he doing the voice right, or do you have a better way of doing it? Can we hear your Loyal?
That's his Loyal, and then mine is obviously not quite that deep, but
Loyal is very kind and very sweet and deliberate.
That's fantastic.
I mean, it is. It's when especially in the first book, I want to say the first book was. Now they're getting to be, I want to say that they're split about 50-50, but I remember, I think, Jen, you had all of about 30 pages in the first book, and I was like, oh, my God. And then as he's moved through, it's become much more, the women characters have to the point where now, I think in the last two books, it's been almost 60-40 women to men emotions. But
one of my favorite characters was the Murdrol.
Oh yeah,
because it's sort of he describes the character as being, I mean, like the scent of death, like breathing death, and it's just this horrible sort of wasteland of a person. And so that one sort of a very gravelly, weird kind of popping noise. And you can go anywhere with it, you know. You just sort of pick something extreme and then find the variations within that. And it's great fun.
So how do you guys prep for all these voices? Do you talk that way to each other in the kitchen, or when you're taking a shower, do you practice them? How do you rehearse these voices, and do you do it together?
We don't do it together, really. I know, I'll speak for myself. When I'm encountering a character for the first time, it is usually a very instinctive choice that is born out of the text up to that point, the description of the character, the introduction to the character. And there are so many characters in this series that you couldn't go wrong unless you hesitated. You know, you could just jump off and make a bold choice, and it was usually right, as long as it was bold.
Yeah, I have to say the same thing. It's because of the number of characters and also just the physical limitation, like that you have within certain contexts. I mean, when you have six men having a conversation, and you don't have the benefit of, say, nationality, that, or at least known nationality. That's the one thing I think that, other than I think Ilion, the Ilioner accent, for the most part, the accents are hard to discern from the writing, but the Ilioner one is very Scotch. You have 8-10 characters speaking, and especially if they're the same sex, to differentiate between them is often difficult. And yet you have to be subtle in that regard, or you have to be really bold because that's the only way you're going to be able to tell the voices apart. And I guess that's the other thing, is that I think we both come from the school of finding the voice for the character. I know some narrators tend they move forward and they don't need to distinguish. I think I'm speaking out of turn for you, Jen, but I'm of a mind that, you know, there is a voice for each particular character, you know, and it's, even though it may be subtly different from the one that's there.
And very often you can be guided by the character's attitude.
Yeah.
So that you're not making a sort of arbitrary choice. Oh, his voice is going to sound like this. It's born out of knowing that this character is a very self-deprecating person, or a very aggressive person, or, you know, some character trait that will guide you. And if you're open to it, your voice will naturally take on that quality and will sound quite different, even though you're not saying, oh, I need to give him a higher pitch, or I need to give him a lower pitch. It's a more subtle, but it ends up being a bigger distinction.
Right, finding the physicality of the characters, you know, it supplies that other thing.
Nynaeve is one of my favorites,
yeah,
because she's very like me. In fact, Michael and I would sort of talk about how, you know, I'm not going to say that we played at being different characters with each other in the privacy of our own home, but certainly there were, like, character traits where we would be having an argument, or we would be having a discussion, or we'd be doing something, and then, you know, he would say, "That's very naive of you." Or
do you pull your braid?
Yes, exactly. Spit nails.
So, with regards to actually creating the books from a more technical point of view, do you guys just sit down and read them on through, or is there a very technical process in terms of doing them one voice at a time or one portion or one chapter at a time? How does that work?
Well, when we started, wait a minute, were you doing that when we started?
Yeah.
I think we were doing DAT tapes. Remember DAT? And we would, one would record and then get to the end of that section, and then the other person would go in the booth and pick up recording and keep going.
I think we were on ADAT.
We were on ADAT already, so with the ADAT. So it really was, both of us had to be home, because sometimes the switch would be a couple of pages long. He'd have 2 pages, and then I'd go in and do 40, and then he'd go in and do 30, and then I'd go in and do 5, and then... And with the last couple of projects, we've done... Each of us has recorded our own stuff and just marked down the times and then sent it in, and it's been edited together, which is much more efficient, really.
How long does it take to do a 700-page Robert Jordan novel, all in all?
I find it takes between 2 and 3 times the amount of time it takes to read it. So if you have 10 hours of recording, it's between 20 and 30 hours to produce it.
And that and that's largely a function of to a certain degree, whether you're moving into with new characters or whether you're back with old characters, because, for instance, every time you would go into a new area, for instance, when we went, I can remember this distinctly, going into the Aiel Waste, and all of a sudden there was just a huge number of new characters, and part of that is just a pure research thing in terms of recording the characters, kind of who they are, and putting them into our what I call our
We have a three-ring binder that is an inch and a half thick. That probably has, a couple thousand.
Oh, easily, yeah.
Characters and how we pronounced their names, and maybe a note about what kind of voice they have.
Yeah. And then and
it's
forward.
So huge.
Yeah, and the other thing is. Now you can go. There are some characters who you haven't seen for 2 books, which in our case means we potentially haven't seen them for 2 years. And then it's like, oh, ooh, you know, and it rings a bell. It's like, oh, that's the, okay, this guy or that guy. When you get into a good, I mean, for me, I love Perrin and Fail. I mean, Perrin and Fail, that whole romance or struggle, you know, to me has always been my favorite. For those sections I just fly through, but then other sections you just kind of grind down because it gets complicated. The complication is all of a sudden you're confronted with a scene with many different voices and or new things, and you're trying to figure out, what should I do with that? But most of it is intuitive, but it's intuitive informed by the writing. And then, you know, obviously having done, the 10 volumes? Is it 10 so far?
10.
Yes, and I noted actually in your question, I think we've also done A Crown of Swords and The Path of Daggers too. We started out doing this series for books on tape,
right.
And then another company was reissuing them, and so we re-recorded several books for them.
Right.
Wow. Yeah. Why couldn't you just use the previous one? It's because they were legal reasons.
They
wanted their own. And which was actually kind of fun to go back into them because. You know, anytime you have a second shot at it. I don't know. That's always a question. You know, sometimes that initial blush, so to speak, when you encounter the character.
You get inspired.
You get inspired, and then all of a sudden there is the danger of trying to repeat it as opposed to just
recreating.
Yeah, finding something new.
So with New Spring, the novel, it was the audiobook was released at the same time as the hardcover novel, and our understanding is that that's the plan for Knife of Dreams, which is coming out later this year.
Who's publishing that?
Tor Books is publishing it in the U.S.
And is it their audio division that's doing the audiobook?
I don't know the answer to that. Bob, okay. Do you know that information?
I'm not sure. I think that's been the biggest change over the course of 15 years. It used to be that the audiobook would be released 2 to 3 months after the hardcover was released. And so you were working from the finished book. Nowadays, because of all the publicity that's being pumped out in terms of the print copy, the audiobook producer wants to take advantage of that, partly because people who listen to audiobooks want to be current. They don't want to be 2 to 3 months behind. They want to come into the office or whatever and talk about the book with everybody else who's reading it. So most of the time now, in the last 5 years, I can count on one hand the number of books I've actually done that were hard copy books as opposed to working from a galley. And sometimes you're working from, well, actually with Robert Jordan, I remember when we first got volume 8 or 9, we got it, and then they said, we started to work on it, and they said, nope. Scrap that, because he had made changes.
Yeah.
And so we started over. Most of the time the galleys are in decent shape, although sometimes they're not, and that's always a challenge too, because it's like, oh, is this a sentence or what's this or whatever.
Trying to read some editors. Yes. Crabbed handwriting that's squished into the margin, right. Saying, okay, this is an insert and it's going here, but I can't tell what that word is,
So with regards to, if you were given the opportunity, would you go ahead and do the remainder of the series?
Absolutely.
Oh yeah.
We feel a little possessive about the series at this point, We spent almost 10 years working with Mr. Jordan here.
Yeah.
What sort of upcoming projects do you have besides Knife of Dreams?
Well, given the new nature of the publishing timelines, it's very different. We used to have books stacked on our shelf and months to complete them, and now it's like we get a call, we need this book, can you do it? And it needs to be in by the end of a fortnight from now. So there aren't very many projects that I know about that are coming up. In fact, we haven't been contacted about doing Knife of Dreams. I'm just assuming that they'll call us, but we don't really know.
Yeah, most of the time you don't get the call until about 2 weeks before, or 2 days before, 2 weeks before they want it.
Yeah.
Right now, I just finished a book, a financial book actually, a David Bach book, and I'm working on a Raoul Wallenberg biography, and then a couple of inspirational books, and what's the book you're working on?
I just got the new Nick Hornby book, which is 4 characters, 2 male and 2 female, and I'm doing the 2 female characters, and Simon Vance and Scott Brick are doing the male ones. So we're all... You see, here's another funny thing. I called Simon Vance, and I was like, well, you've already recorded your segment, which includes my characters' voices. What did you make them sound like? And luckily he's from England, so, and those characters are all British, and so he said, oh well, I sort of did this. And I said, okay, go. Well, I was thinking of this and this. And he was like, yeah, that's so good. So we're on the same page. But there again, you've got two narrators in California and one in Washington working on a project together. That's all. It's a series of monologues, each from the perspective of the various different characters. And within each monologue, there's dialogue that includes the other characters. So we're all doing each other's characters, and we don't have an idea of what they sound like, you know? It's bizarre.
So knowing that you guys have read all the 11 Wheel of Time books thus far, and you've had feedback from Robert Jordan, he's given you some insight, and you've had all this experience and all this rehearsal, with all the facts that you've seen, who do you guys think killed Asmodean?
I'm turning this one over to Michael.
I don't know. That's back a ways, I want to say, if I'm not mistaken. It could be Mogedion. It could be it could have been what's his name down in Tyr? What was his name?
Usually when anyone asks these questions of Rob Jordan, he kind of just looks at us and tells us to keep reading or to read on and find out, as he will say. And so
yeah, I mean,
your guess is as good as ours.
Yeah, it's hard. I don't know. I can't say because it was deliberately shrouded in that that was when it was at the Wells, right? Dumai's Wells.
It was in a previous book, but the it was at when they were up in Camelin at the very end when Rand and Ravin are fighting there. But it's one of those, you know, there's so many characters and everything, and so there's so many plot threads, and that just happens to be the one that all the fans enjoy the most, is trying to figure out who exactly killed this guy, and it's this big mystery. And it was,
I think it's Miguel, personally.
Yeah,
I think she did it. But it could be, yeah. My bigger question is what's the transsexual character?
Osengar and Arengar.
Yeah. Who is that? Because that's obviously a reincarnation, but we're never told who it's a reincarnation of.
He leaves clues around, and you know.
Yeah, I mean that's to me kind of the you know, was one review saying this is the best series in terms of how you can end it and yet open it up to the next one. You know, it's like it's a weave that just keeps on finding itself. I mean, that's.
Well, all in all, if there's one last question here, what's a question that no one has ever asked you that you wish they would have asked? What's something that you would like to tell everyone either about or share with us? What's some story or tidbit about your careers together or in voice acting in general or about the Wheel of Time that you'd like to share with us?
That's a toughie.
That wasn't on the script, sorry.
No, it's let me think about.
Is there any particular story? You mentioned that one time you were you guys getting these little tiffs trying to figure out who's, you know, pronouncing the names correctly. Do you have any other interesting story? Or is there perhaps you guys have a lot of outtakes that you obviously wouldn't make it into the final edit but would be really interesting if they were?
No, because the nature of it is that you're in the booth by yourself, so it isn't that, you know, that way.
I think for me the sort of the most interesting aspect of doing this series is the the fervor that people feel about this series is it's quite extraordinary. We were at a party, a theater party one time, and this friend of ours who has a son, and at the time I think his son was maybe 12 or 13, his son found out, because we started talking about this series at the party, that we were recording this series. And his whole face, I mean, he was a sort of, you know, typical kind of, you know, preteen boy. He's a bit more outgoing than most, but his face just lit up, and apparently he and his mother were both rabid, rabid Robert Jordan fans. And
he was jealous because we were reading galleys.
We had to slip him the galley pages. Yeah. Like when we finished recording, we'd like take the book over and go, here you go, Nick, read it quickly because you've got to send it back in tomorrow, you know. And I was just struck by the, and I guess it's true also of the fans of The Lord of the Rings when that came out, just the sort of nature of this series is that people, well, and then 2 years ago I was doing a play with a young man who also found out that we recorded the series, and he couldn't believe it because he'd been reading the books, you know, for the last 10 years since he was a teenager. And I brought him a copy of some of the audiobooks that we'd done, and he was in heaven. He couldn't believe it. And it just inspires, the series just inspires such a loyal and fervent feeling in the people that stick with the series and really love it. And I love that. I just love that. I think it's really great. It's sort of, it gives the series a kind of heart, you know, that when you know about it, it's like, yes, you're very respectful when you record it because there are lots and lots of people who really care about each new character and where the series goes. So it's been really wonderful to be working on it over the years.
So how does that, ultimately, how does that make you feel knowing that for, you know, thousands and thousands of people, you guys will always be the voice of Randall Thor and Perrin Ibarra and all these other characters that, as you said, people enjoy so much?
Pretty cool, you know. I mean, it's great that I get to do that for a living, you know.
It's very flattering to a certain degree. I mean, you feel very fortunate that because you there are lots of books you read and you wonder who's going to be actually listening to this, and to know that no, this one is going to be picked up and listened to and re-listened to, and it gives you. It inspires you to, you know, I mean, every book you should do that, you know, give it the kind of care that, oh, you know, you are leading this person, you are leading the listener through that story, so you are the guide, you are, you know, you make it murky and they can't see, and so there's a real...
Yeah, I mean, I just hope they like our choices, and I hope they forgive us for our mistakes, because I know that there are millions of mistakes we must make.
Well, all in all, on behalf of myself and Bob and everyone that who's listening, thank you very much for your time in doing this interview. I hope we didn't keep you too long. We really enjoyed talking with you tonight. Is there anything else you'd like or like to share? Or
well, but thank you very much for asking us to do this. It was a great pleasure.
Yeah.
Great. Maybe we'll do it again another time sometime.
That'd be great.
Yeah, we'd love to do it. Once we know who killed Asmodean, we'll come back and we'll dissect the whole
thing. Now I've got to go back and reread it.
It's at the end of book five.
Yeah, I know. Is it before Dumai's Wells?
Yeah, Dumai's Wells is at the end of book six.
Okay. So then it's... Right. Okay.
All right, guys. Well, thank you very, very much for your time. Bob, are you still on the line there?
Yes, I am, and if you allow me, I will close. Thank you very much. This has been DragonMount.com presenting you with an interview with Michael Kramer and Kate Redding, the voice actors for the Wheel of Time series.